Good morning once more.
Morning.
We're a little out of step. This is a topic that would have come Thursday evening. It's part of a series that numerous of you didn't hear the earlier segments of. The series has been about the social shape of the Christian community, with special reference to the newness of the gospel. It is things that can be said about the Christian community because of the work of redemption and the Spirit, with attention as well to the spillover from the way the Christian community ought to be a social body to what we say to the wider world about what would be a decent human community. This time it's the economics of the Eucharist, and in order to explain putting those two words together, we have to back up a little. Classically, anybody who has studied the history of Christian denominations knows that the Eucharist is a subject of debate between denominations. The Lutherans and the Calvinists differed on the definition, as they both moved away in the 16th century from what the Catholics were saying about the definition of the meaning of the emblems in the celebration. And those debates are going on up to the present. Only in our century are there theologians from these various separate communities who are beginning to say that it might be possible to find less divided formulations for those questions. But those are post-medieval questions. You know, the parlor game or educational exercise that people sometimes use, you get a row of people in a circle. The first one whispers a sentence to the second whispers it to the third, and by the time you get all the way around, the message is not recognizable. Something like that has happened to the Eucharist from the first century to the 16th. I propose to start over with the story, and that, of course, means it has to be oversimple and naive, but I think there is a merit in trying that once in a while. I was encouraged to think that might be done because one of the first evenings we were here about 2 weeks ago, John Schramm said that a lot of the ways we have been talking about the Eucharist don't fit. I don't know what he meant, but you'll see what use I think we should make of that openness to review. Jesus said to his disciples, "Do this in memory of me." Or do what? Well, eat and drink. But eat and drink what? Was this a Passover celebration? There are some aspects of the interpretation of this event. It's in the Passover period. The prayers of blessing over cup and bread are like the Passover ritual. But if what he meant was, when you celebrate the Passover, remember me, that would only be meaningful for the Jewish church, and it would be something to do once a year. And there doesn't seem to be any record that any Christians took him that way. Well, then, might he have meant some other kind of formal meal celebration? There existed in his culture a thing called fellowship, chabura, like what we call koinonia, meaning a sharing group. This was not something that Jesus invented. The various Christian groups, the pious groups of the time in Judaism formed circles like this, and one of the things they did together was to have fellowship meals. And that was weekly, monthly. Maybe Jesus said, whenever you have a fellowship meal together, remember me. More likely, but this isn't where we have come to draw our information, Jesus meant something far more concrete and far more current, namely what he had been doing with his disciples all the time. Jesus had been a wandering teacher to a circle of, an inner circle of disciples who wandered with him. A wider circle of disciples who came to listen to him didn't travel, but there was an itinerant group of some number, not only the 12, but we read that there were women who came along. Whether they were doing the housekeeping in a standard proper women's role, or whether they were disciples in some stronger sense, like Mary, The text doesn't say, but Jesus was the head of a family who ate together every day. And it's most likely that that's what he meant. When you keep on eating as my family together, and any family eats together all the time, remember me. So that this was not, first of all, a ceremonial event which Jesus from scratch instituted. It was rather something you do all the time if you're in the same family. And Jesus says, go on doing it in my memory.
Is that that continuing aspect, is that present in the verbs that are used there?
Do this doesn't say what the this is at all.
Yeah.
The one thing it can't have meant is every time you celebrate the Christian Eucharist, because there was no such thing as the Christian Eucharist. The meaning we give it, it can't have had. It had to have a meaning then. And the three I can think of are the ones I mentioned. It could be a Passover meal, it could be a Chaburah meal, or it could be a family meal. It wasn't a restaurant meal, and it wasn't a Christian Eucharist, because there was no such thing. We can back up and see a little more of how important it was then that Jesus had a circle of people who ate the family meal with him. And let's go backwards rather than forwards. Behind this was the early preaching of Jesus, who said that among other things that his ministry was going to mean, it was to be fulfilling the prophetic expectation of sharing, for which the prophetic language that was the most dramatic and which Jesus picks up from the prophet, the book of Isaiah, is jubilee. Now, what jubilee means in the life of the Jews of the first century, we're not too clear, but it's clear what it means in the Bible, is in their Bible, in the Old Testament. In the Mosaic legislation, it was provided that since the land really belongs to the Lord, the families that have the privilege of farming this piece of it only have it in trust. They may lose it if they are poor managers or have bad luck or don't have enough children to help them till the soil and fall into debt and lose it. Or other people may gain more because they are good managers or have good luck or have plenty of children to help them till the soil and they become prosperous. But every 50 years, that's going to start over. And their land will go back to the original family, or the descendants of the original owners. So that the Mosaic legislation, among other things that it provided by way of the rights of gleaners and the rights of widows and orphans, also provided for a regular, every second generation, a regular redistributing of the basic land capital of the economy of the people. Now, we don't know whether that was ever done with any profound faithfulness by the Jewish people, but it's there in the law, and it's there in the prophets. So Jesus quotes as his platform statement in his first appearance as a speaker that's recorded in his home synagogue of Nazareth, according to Luke 4, he quotes from Isaiah chapter 61. And here the prophet is speaking as the Messiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. Anointed is the word Messiah. Has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. So the Messiah, the anointed one, the Spirit bearer, is the one whose task is to bring good news to the poor. And then this good news is spelled out. Proclaiming release to captives, recovering of sight to the blind, setting at liberty the oppressed, proclaiming the acceptable year of the Lord. Recovery of sight to the blind is a different kind of salvation, a different kind of mighty work. But the other three all have to do with economic liberation of slaves, and most slaves were debt slaves, and proclaiming the acceptable year of the Lord. In Greek, or in our translations, you have no reason to know what the acceptable year of the Lord means unless you have the help of the commentators in the Hebrew usage, which makes it very clear that that is the year of Jubilee. And then Jesus says, that's now. This is fulfilled in your midst. With me being here, this is now that. We can't try to settle with any clarity or detail what that meant, that Jesus was proclaiming the application to his age of the Jubilee expectation. Did he mean that this year there ought to be a redistribution, and then 50 years later there should be another one? Or did he mean simply, in my coming, the deep reality behind that promise, namely that everything belongs to the Lord and therefore it's to be shared, is now going to be a common experience. Whichever that was, it did mean something that in the ministry of Jesus, economic sharing and the leveling of the difference of economic privilege was part of his work. It had also been promised in the Magnificat, the Song of Mary. It had been predicted in the preaching of John the Baptist. So there's plenty of background for expecting that the work of Jesus is going to mean sharing bread. And bread in the symbolism that has come to have, again, in the youth slang of the 60s and 70s, is what you have to live on, including money. Before that, there had been the theology of the land in all of the Old Testament, that the land of promise was still Yahweh's land. It didn't belong to the people who were farming it. He let them use it for their needs and for their community according to his law, but also for the needs of the poor. The rights of gleaners and widows and orphans were also stated in the law. Once Jesus' movement had begun, it is at several places at least defined for people who are thinking of joining him in terms of joining him economically. Especially the rich young ruler is one of the stories that we have in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. The challenge to this person was to join Jesus and be freed from his own personal management of his private wealth. We know the teachings of Jesus in the discursive part of the moral teaching of the Sermon on the Mount. You can't serve both God and mammon. He doesn't say, this is said well by Clarence Jordan in his interpretation, which is, used to be in the bookstore here. He doesn't say it's a hard trick to bring off to serve both God and mammon. He doesn't say if you try to serve God and mammon, you'll have trouble. He says you can't serve God and mammon because each is a Lord. And if God is going to be your Lord and you're following me, that will mean your participation in the sharing of the goods that you bring to the community. There would be more to say about why that is preached, about why it is part of the call of Jesus. But for now, it's sufficient to say that that was concretized in the experience of the closest followers of Jesus by the fact that they actually had a common purse and a common table. And what he says in the upper room is most simply and literally meaningful if it meant, go on with your common table in my absence and think of me then as present with you. To move on then, we need only to look at the other word that I put in my other title, Jubilee and Resurrection. We discover that a surprising number of the resurrection accounts are connected with the disciples being at the table with Jesus. They're the two people who are on the road to Emmaus. They don't recognize the person who falls into step with them and starts talking with them about how what had just happened shouldn't surprise them because it was in the prophets. They don't recognize him until they have gone into the house and they're at the table and he takes the bread and he takes again his position as head of the household, pronounces the prayers of thanksgiving and breaks the bread, and then they know it's the Lord. They run back to Jerusalem to give the word in John 20, and again in John 21, there's again food. John 20, he appears and he eats something because he wants people like Thomas to know that he has a body. And John 21, he is prepared to breakfast on the shore when they come in with their too many fish. In Acts 1:4, there is a verb that appears only once, so the scholars aren't really sure what it means. But it may mean that they were eating together. In the Revised Standard, it's a footnote. While staying with them, he charged them not to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father, footnote, or eating. And that's Professor Oscar Kuhlmann thinks that that really means eating. And again, that the resurrection appearances are connected with the table. And likewise, that the Eucharistic experiences are connected with the presence of the Lord in a special way. There is one of the few non-Greek words that we have in the New Testament, Maranatha, Maranatha in English, which means Lord, come. And that seems to have been part of the Eucharistic liturgy. So that the practice of the breaking of bread together was the time when the church was especially clear about the presence of Jesus in their midst. It's from this common eating that we see the movement of the history of the church in the early chapters of the book of Acts. In Acts 2, at the end of the Pentecost account, the summary accentuates that the new believers ate together. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. Fear came on every soul. Many wonders and signs were done. All who believed were together and had things in common, sold their possessions and goods, distributed them to all as any had need. Day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes. They partook of food. That's the third time. There's a third verb in this paragraph talking about eating bread together. With glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with the people. So the church of Pentecost was a church that ate together. All the time. Regularly. And that comes again in the end of chapter 4, which lays the scene for the Ananias and Sapphira story in chapter 5. The sharing of goods in the early church was not the result of a communalist idealism. That is, the idea that common property is questionable, and if we share our property, we'd be better. It maybe ought to throw light on that kind of question. But it was much simpler than that. It was that they were always eating together, and anybody who could help buy the bread did. That common life was, that was their common life. The fact that they regularly ate together. The most elementary thing that people do to keep alive, they did it together with people with whom they were only brought together because of the common Lord. It's the family concept of the people who share at the table has been taken over by the church. And they eat together in joy because of the resurrection. This is the basis on which then the community of goods arose, not from some other philosophizing about what would be a good economic order. This is the basis in chapter 6 from which we get the development of their first change in ministerial leadership. Because the management of this enormous operation of thousands of people sharing in house church meals, it took a lot of management, and one particular category of people weren't getting their share, namely the widows of the non-Palestinian part of the culture. And this is maybe worth explaining a little. They were called Hellenists. That doesn't mean they were Greek. It means that they were Greek-speaking people because they had grown up and had their economically productive part of their life spent in Corinth or Ephesus or somewhere else, and then they came back to Jerusalem for their old age. It was the precursors of the modern retirement community. People went to Jerusalem to retire. And as is still the case, the men died younger, so there are more widows left than widowers. And normally they would be taken care of by the Jewish synagogue. But now these people, because they have become believers in Christ, are pushed out of the Jewish synagogue. They're still Jews. They're still in the Jewish movement. But they have been pushed out of the non-Messianic synagogue. So they are especially in need of the economic support of the Christian community. They don't have family in the countryside around Jerusalem the way the Aramaic-speaking believers did. And they were not getting quite as much attention as their need would have warranted. So the first thing that happens in the development of the early church as a new structure is that the 12 say, we can't manage this, we need 7 more people. The 7 people they choose are all Hellenists, that is, are also people of this non-Aramaic, non-Palestinian background. The reason for this new leadership development is in order to manage the breaking of bread together, the eating together. That's what makes church history happen. The first event in church history, in a sense, after Pentecost. is an adjustment to a better way to manage the eating together. 1 Corinthians 11, then, one of the chapters where we have a part of the tradition of the initial events of the upper room, which we celebrate, which we use in the words of the liturgy. The Apostle Paul is talking to the church in Corinth. Well, we've covered a lot of ground from Jerusalem to Corinth, and that would take a story. But these people, too, are eating together, and it's a meal. It's not just a ceremony. It's not just a religious ritual. It's a meal of which it can be said that there's something wrong because some people get all they need to eat and others don't have enough. That's the reproach. These people are having a Eucharistic meal, but they aren't really sharing anymore, or they haven't come really to share. They don't see that the meaning of this sharing ought to be that everybody should have equally according to their need. They have carried into the church some of the social segregation of their own pre-Christian background. And Paul says that's wrong. The meaning of this should be a sharing in which there is equality. And secondly, it shouldn't just be a party. It should be somewhat sober and solemn. That, in fact, he needs to say that. Probably indicates that it was kind of a party. Some people had more than they needed. And then Paul reminds them, when you do this, you show forth the Lord's death. Paul brings in the reference to the death of Christ as a corrective against its being only a party or only a happy meal. The reference to sacrifice and to the "this is my body given for you" or this cup stands for my blood, those references are brought back into the awareness of the church at Corinth by Paul in order that they see more deeply that this sharing together is part of the redemption that Christ has worked. It's not just human togetherness. It's not just a happy meal together. From there on, the history of the development of the doctrine of the Eucharist took off from Paul's corrective and theologized about that corrective. What does it mean that he says, remember in the book of the bread and the wine, the dying body and the shed blood? And from then on, we have the evolution of centuries of theological history about the Eucharist as a discussion of what happened to the bread and what happened to the wine. But that's already a generation down the road in the life of the early church. The first thing that happened was that they ate together because people need food, and that need they met together. The other change that we find in the ministry of the Apostle Paul is that the root meaning of sharing bread at a table has to be translated now that the church has become a global, or an, not yet worldwide, but an intrinsically international and more than local unity. How do you break bread together between Corinth and Jerusalem? Well, you transpose that into sending money from Corinth to Jerusalem. So much of the ministry of the Apostle Paul is collecting money in Greece to take back to Jerusalem. And for that money, he uses the word fellowship, koinonia. That's his word for a collection, a sharing of your bread in the form of money, that's portable bread, to be taken to that part of the church from which we got the message and where the needs are special because of the special sociology of Jerusalem. In Romans 15:27, he says that if we share spiritually, we should also share materially. Toward the end of that chapter, he says that he's going to be going from wherever he is, probably Corinth, to Jerusalem to carry this money to them. He hopes they'll accept it. It's a specimen of theological solidarity. He doesn't even know whether his ministry is still acceptable enough that they'll take it, but on theological grounds, he must make the collection and bring it to them. And extended passages in 2 Corinthians talk about the theological importance of this act of fellowship. So the basis of the economic solidarity of the Christian community is not ethical in the ordinary sense of those words. That is, it doesn't flow from thinking about right behavior that's commanded by God or wrong behavior that is forbidden by God. It doesn't flow, first of all, from discussing what is functional, what's the best way to keep a community working. although I'm in favor of ethics as a discipline, a way of thinking, but it's deeper than that. It's bigger than that. It's spiritual, or it's sacramental. The basis of economic solidarity is that the work of Christ has put us at the same table. The work of Christ has called us to share together the basic necessity of life. And this new family polity, belonging together in the solidarity of eating from the same table, is the work of God. That's what it means to be reconciled. The basis of this newness and this sharing is, as we saw the other hours on other subjects, spoken of in the New Testament more solidly in terms of redemption or new creation than in terms of creation. Of course, we could say from our created nature we all ought to share. We could say that the simplicity of the family structure should show us that sharing is the normal thing you do with people you belong to. That can be argued. But it's not creation utopianism, talking about a golden age at the beginning when there wasn't discrimination and we've lost it. Sorry. It's not just saying we could project an ideal world in which there wouldn't be discrimination. No, it's saying we are beginning a real world in which there is sharing. Because as Jesus called his first disciples to leave their nets and their farms, their plows and their households to follow him, so that they would be together with him in this new regime, so we are called into that same newness. There has been, in the history of Western Christianity, a continuing critique of economic selfishness and stratification. The church at large lost that vision at the same time that other parts of the church's vision for equal dignity of all kinds of people and for the reduction of violence were lost in the early Middle Ages, but the critique remained alive. There were strong movements of renewal already in the 10th and 11th centuries, long before what we call the Reformation, in which they made a point of the renunciation of property as the sign of Christian faithfulness. There were several movements called Christ's Poor in the 11th and 12th centuries, culminating then in the Franciscan movement as the most dramatic expression of it, but other monastic movements as well, and also the Waldensian movement, an early, nearly Protestant development in the 12th century, in which wealth itself was the best symbol of what's wrong with the fallenness of the church. The word they gave to that was simony. Where would you get a word like that? Well, from in Acts chapter 8. After the ministry of other people, especially Philip, had brought about the presence of a church in Samaria, that is, there were believers in Samaria. The senior apostles had to come from Jerusalem to make this all right by integrating those people into the church at large and in fellowship with the Jerusalem church. And when Peter laid hands on these people, they received the Holy Spirit. Simon was one of these people, had been a leader in the pre-conversion event, or in the life of that community before. He offered Peter, asked how much it would cost for him to be able to do that. So simony had become, in the Middle Ages, the name for the sin of buying church office. Of course, it doesn't quite fit because Simon didn't buy it, because Peter wouldn't sell it to him. Peter said, as Phillips translates it, to hell with you and your money. And Simon repented. So Simon did not commit the sin of simony, but his name got that sin on the books. And in the Middle Ages, it was very important that many bishops' offices became the centers of enormous wealth. Because a bishop is not supposed to have children, and therefore the wealth stays in the office. Anybody else gets wealthy has several children, so it gets scattered. So people would buy a bishop's office. It would be a good investment to pay the archbishop to ordain you as the next bishop, and then you'd have a good living from the inheritance from the previous occupants of that throne. So simony was the sin that the preachers and the renewal people most castigated in the High Middle Ages. as unworthy of true spiritual leaders, but being committed by many of the princes of the church. The monasteries then themselves got wealthy because of the same kind of phenomenon. What they shared stayed in the hands of the monastery as the first generation passed on, and they would be respected, and people would come bringing their wealth. So that by the time of the Protestant Reformation, the monasteries themselves were also guilty of simony in the minds of the Renouers. And one of the main criticisms of this whole system of the Protestant reformers, like Martin Luther, was that the monasteries shouldn't exist and shouldn't be wealthy. So that was a part of the economic critique of the Protestant Reformation. And there have been, since the 16th century, numerous forms of renewal which would bring this economic dimension of concern back into awareness. Some, like the Hutterian Brethren from the 16th century, or the Amana community, which came to Iowa. They kept the name and given up on the community of goods, but some of them did actually restore what they thought was an imitation of the full economic community pattern of the early church. Many other renewal movements, like the other 16th century Anabaptists who didn't become Hutterians, or the 15th century Czech Brethren, or some of the reformers in the British Reformation in the 17th century, the age of Cromwell, the Diggers and the Levellers, also found radical ways of saying that the impact of the gospel on our economic life must be to make us again able to share, give us the freedom to share, free us from the service of mammon. So again, the economic agenda is not a matter of ethics, but a matter of lordship or of worship. God's purpose in giving us bread is that we should share it with all at his table. Now, in very recent times, from within Roman Catholicism, this kind of concern has arisen, or from a few other church renewal circles. The Iona community off the coast of Scotland was an old monastic settlement that had gone out of business, was restored two generations ago under the leadership of a number of British people, mostly Scottish Presbyterians, under the leadership of Lord George MacLeod. That was one place where they started saying in their renewal movement, not only the community proper on the island, but in the ministries which they then supported in Great Britain, that the Eucharist is a symbol of our social critique and our social vision. When we share bread together, we are celebrating the claim that God calls all his children to share their bread together and to be the first fruits of the people who know they're his children are to be the first fruits of that sharing. And now that is being done much more broadly in some Roman Catholic circles. There are whole books being written about this, the Eucharist as a base for economic change. One of the first in North America was written by a woman theologian in Washington, Monica Helwig. And there are other books now coming out rather frequently, so it's no longer a new idea at all, and it would be worthy of study, and it might well be that the fact that that arises in the Catholic tradition will make it more credible and, to play on the words a little, more edible than if it were liberal Protestants coming up with the notion. That is, people who have traditionally said it matters before God that we be very serious about what it means that we should often break bread together, to see this again, as it was in the beginning, as not a discussion of what that mouthful of bread has come to be because of the words that the preacher said over it, but how that represents, how the fact that you do it together, the fact that you are sharing from the same loaf and from the same cup, symbolizes God's claim that we should be sharing his creation with one another according to our need. Some of the other times I focused on just one or two passages and looked at it more closely. This time it's a much more broad question without deep analysis of any one text. But otherwise, I think the same kind of logic applies to what we've discovered. The call to share and the call to care for the poor is part of the work of redemption. It is not just a matter of moral duties. And it comes to us more clearly out of the ministry of Jesus as liberator, as initiator of a new age, more than it comes to us from our meditation about human nature or the nature of society or the meaning of the economic order. Well, of course, we can develop from this into thinking about the economic order. And it has been from this kind of Christian bias that such economic egalitarianism as has worked in the wider society, the development of a vision of cooperative economic structure or the rights of the poor, have generally come from the kind of Christian that made this point, first of all, about the Christian community, and then they also made it about the wider society. So much for beginning. Now, Larry, you named another author once, a couple days ago, who also has written a similar kind of book.
Yeah, Gustave Martelet.
Martelet.
The Risen Christ and the Eucharistic World. Which?
Be French.
A French Jesuit, which is just another one in what you were mentioning, a Roman Catholic attention to this. John, I find it, this intriguing, and would just like to mention a couple of other things that and invite your response. One, without having the time to look at Old Testament materials, just to note that the same pattern is there throughout the Old Testament. The book by Walter Brueggemann that I think is very suggestive of prophetic imagination talks about an economics that arises out of redemption, that is, the wilderness experience with mm-hmm. manna, which is then appealed to by Paul in the Jerusalem offering. And comes up again with the prophets. I mean, it's just the same pattern. Mm-hmm. The worker that's grounded in redemption means for us as a community economic sharing. And then the other, throughout the Old Testament, is contrasted with what happens under Solomon that happens similarly under the Pharaoh, where you had an economics of concentrated wealth that ran counter to the economics of sharing, and the appeal is always to the redemptive act of Yahweh as the way to get, remember that, to get things straightened out again. Then the other thing is, which I'm not competent to talk about, but I would be interested in your response. My colleague in New Testament, Joe Weber, contends that it is, in fact, the sitting at table with sinners and the gathering together of a new family that is one of the primary reasons for Jesus' crucifixion. That it is eating and sharing table in the kingdom that becomes a place of offense. And gathering this group together out of the families, out of various groups, that becomes so from that side, crucifixion and not just resurrection and post-resurrection fellowship, the whole formation of the family and the sharing of meals together is a part of the drama of redemption, as a part of the passion.
Now, that Jesus eating at table with sinners was offensive, that's clear in the text. I don't right away know what Joe would mean by way of a causative link to the crucifixion, but certainly it's part of the rejection of his message. By the proper people.
Yeah.
That he was creating a new family on new grounds.
Yeah. Well, I think the causation is indirect. I mean, Jesus was offensive to these people who then were among those that either called for the crucifixion or did not oppose it when someone else called for it.
What connection do you see between what you've been saying and the role of government? Such ends?
Well, I wouldn't start by assuming that it is automatically yes or no, that for the wider society, government would be another instrument of this. That would just depend on the world we're in. If I were a Christian of a tiny minority with no status in the wider society, then there'd be no point in asking that question. That was the way these Christians worked in the first century. there was no connection with what Rome would do as a possible instrument of this. So all of the sharing, whether among Christians themselves or even taking care of the other poor, which Christians started to be famous for doing already in the second and third century, was done by the church from their own resources. If we get in a completely different kind of cultural situation so that the public authorities are open to learning from our vision, our proclamation, then I wouldn't say it's wrong to think that the other instruments of social organization outside the church might also learn from this vision and might be instruments of sharing too. I was just rereading before this hour, wondering whether it would be something I could quote at more length. What Martin Luther said on this kind of subject in 1523, I decided it would take too much to build the whole bridge to see that he was also in this on this track. It is the early Protestant Reformation called into question all the wealth that these monasteries have. But what are you going to do with it? Well, if you don't look out, the prince will just take it, and that won't be any better. So the people in the small town of Leisnig in 1523 said, we're going to take it over as town, and we're going to arrange to have a poor fund. So we'll get rid of the wealth of the monasteries, but we'll keep the prince from getting it. We'll give it to the poor. In order to do that, we'll have a city, a municipal poor fund. And they had all the full descriptions of how it's going to be managed. In fact, how many people are supposed to be on the board, and they meet every Sunday morning. You have four keys to the chest, so nobody can help himself. They showed this to Martin Luther, and he said, this is so good, I'm going to publish it. And he put a preface to it saying, I hope everybody will do this. So a critiquing of the privatization of wealth was part of the early Lutheran Reformation as well, in the interest instead of resources for the poor. And in this case, they proposed that the city government should do it, and Luther said every government should do it. But of course, that was Christian government in his thought. So whether we ask government to be an instrument of our vision of equalization depends on whether we have a government that will listen. Certainly in the democratic world, we do. And Christians have always called for that. I think that has limits, especially if you think the government should do it instead of the Christians, or if you think the government should do it coercively or bureaucratically, then you bring in some more variables that aren't necessarily redemptive. But certainly to the extent to which we participate in determining what government does with its management of the economy, we would want it to skew it in this direction rather than in the present direction of government in favor of the more for the rich and less for the poor.
Just additional note on the Lutheran Reformation. In Wittenberg, in 1525, Karlstadt started something of the same thing with Luther's approval. There was a community chest. There was a vocational training program. And some things, especially for orphans and children of widows who were poor.
And later renewals in the Lutheran world, the Pietist movements were always started here. They started with children's homes and vocational schools and old people's homes, supported whether by free gifts from people of the new industrial class or by government.
You alluded to the Old Testament as possibly having some parallels, at least as far as the Messianic Age is concerned. I just was intrigued to look up the passage where Paul is talking about the Israelites' practice of eating the sacrifices and then making them partners in the altar. That would be a similar thing, would it not, to what Jesus is doing? I don't know exactly what partners in the altar means.
Well, I think it's just another word for fellowship. It means that the altar is not just a place where you burn something so that God can smell it. The altar is also a table where we eat together. And we forget most of the sacrifice in the Old Testament was eaten. It was the support for the priests and the Levites, and the other people who brought the sacrifice also ate of it. So even the Old Testament sacrifice was a meal fellowship. It is by sharing together your food that you are in the same worship. And it's more than just a symbolic eating. It's what it takes to stay alive. And you brought it from your flock or from your field. So it is a prototype of the sharing of the economy itself. backward.
Just follow up on that. Would that have some help to understand the shock that Paul seems to feel of eating of the things of idols?
I don't think it's so much Paul's own shock as some of the people in the church at Corinth had come from a realistic understanding of pagan sacrificial meal fellowship. And now these people are converted. And they wonder whether it's possible to have any connection at all with the pagan meat market, because all of that meat was slaughtered in front of some deity. But the reason it's a problem is it's that they have a realistic understanding of the sacrificial meal as a real relationship to both being life-sustaining food and drink and a relationship to that altar, that God. In the back.
How do you feel, or what do you know about the idea that the reason for our somber, small, symbolic communion today is that the potluck, so to speak, got out of hand in the early church, and the meal was so extravagant that
I think that's
squelched it down to bread and wine.
That's a better formulation of what I think I did say, that the evolution of the ideas of the Eucharist through the history of theology took off from what in Paul was a corrective. The potluck had got out of hand. So Paul said, remember, it's Christ dying that we're remembering. And we're celebrating his presence, but we're also celebrating his presence as the Lamb and as the one who gave himself. So stop having it be so much of a party that you aren't sharing with each other anymore. Some of you have too much and others don't have enough. I don't know if Paul really meant they should not have fun or not be joyous, but at least don't move into the context of a pagan party that doesn't remember who the Lord is that you're celebrating. And so from that corrective, there evolved the concentration on the body being in the bread, the dying body and the blood, and the theologizing about how that can be, which then was an independent development, and it stopped being a potluck, and it was the theologized meaning of the emblems from then on. So theological history took off from a corrective rather than from the main line of what had been practiced before.
John, what about the need for the pastor or the minister, the priest, to be present and to for the communion celebration? I have some more questions about that. Like, do you hear your thoughts about it, or where did that idea come from?
Well, there were, of course, in the Old Testament priests for that kind of sacrifice. Jesus wasn't a priest, and he did it. And the ordinary Passover is celebrated by the head of household. You don't have to have a priest in Judaism to have a Seder. So there does have to be somebody. It isn't chaotic or anarchistic or orderless. No, it's an orderly process where the head of the household breaks the bread and gives thanks on the bread for the bread and breaks it and passes the cup. So there needs to be order. But that the order needs a priestly quality to make it valid, that developed later, that we don't find anywhere in the New Testament.
You think you carried the order too far?
Well, my biases would be that if we still make an issue of needing a priestly quality to make it valid, then that probably isn't the best way to restore the familial quality of what it was supposed to be. And it certainly gets us off the subject of sharing our bread with the poor, to be discussing the qualities that the guy has to have who says the words. And there has to be a guy that says the words.
What do you think that is, like, the one thing that kind of, especially the Roman Catholic Church, women can preach or they can help celebrate, they can be involved in liturgy, but they can't celebrate the Eucharist. But why do you think that's the one thing that kind of hung on to male vestiture? I mean, it's the one thing. Why do you think that thing over other things?
I heard here I'm speaking from my biases and not from, more study and ability to say it more fairly. But my answer would go back to last night's subject, that is that the gospel ends the phenomenon of the religious specialist, the sacramental person. And Christianity picked that up again in the later centuries from paganism and from memories of Jewish precedents. I think paganism was a stronger source. And created again the religious specialist. And once there is a religious specialist, the most important way to maintain the special claims of a religious specialist is to have a ritual that only that person can do. And, all pagan religions have that. And it was kind of natural to fall back into that after the clarity of the breakthrough in the first century had been lost.
I guess Luther would answer that by referring to 1 Corinthians 4:1, that we're the stewards of the mysteries. Regard us as the stewards of the mysteries.
Yeah.
You mean by us, Pastor?
Paul and his associates, I suppose.
Well, there, I don't know how many people Paul would have meant by that.
Not either.
And I don't know if he would have linked mystery in that sense with mystery as the sacrament of the Eucharist. As when the Paul of Ephesians uses the word mystery, it means the whole plan of God. It doesn't mean a ritual. And the apostle is the steward of the mystery because he's the one to whom it has been revealed what God was doing with his getting ready for the world mission. But I would suspect that you're right that would have been the 16th century claim that there is something of a sacramental mystery that isn't what's wrong with Catholicism, so we want to keep that. And you have to have a special category of formally qualified people to do that thing.
Could you be more specific what you mean by economic sharing? Are we talking communal living? Should we not donate through groups and organizations? Is it all an individual thing? Or what should I do when I go in?
Yes. It is, we should do all kinds of things, and we should do things we haven't thought of yet, and we should do some of the things better that we've already thought of. I think the point I have to make theologically is simply that the bread that we have is not our own. It's to be shared. Whether we share that by living in an extended family or by sending money to Zimbabwe or by volunteer labor in the cause of other people, or by doing what Paul did in Greece, sending money to somewhere else. I don't want to let the issue be made subject to my ability to have a ready-made recipe for how to do it perfectly. We'll have to look for ways to make it more clear than it has been that we want to share our wherewithal with the needy, and that doing it is part of the gospel and is what we celebrate in the Lord's Supper. And then how we figure out to do it, I look for more guidance. I think communal living patterns are one important way, but there's some questions they can't speak to. In the wider society, the co-op and the credit union are one kind of helpful thing. They're also finite in what they can do. In disaster experiences, sending money to Calcutta is something to do. I don't care how we do it. I hope we will do it in more ways, in better ways. But my concern in this hour is to see that it's a spiritual mandate. It's not just an ethical mandate in the sense that it's a virtue to give and it's a vice to be greedy. It's deeper than that. It's what we celebrate in the Lord's Supper. It's part of the meaning of the gospel that we share bread. And that means we'll look for ways. I don't think maximizing the accumulation of private property in a few hands is the best way to do it.
Yeah. My question would be, I just wonder how much patience God will have. It seems like we're not doing a very good job of sharing our food with the poor. And also, if the poor hear this message, I wonder if they might not have a right to demand part of that. So if they hear that message that if they have part of this food and they're not getting it,
Then
maybe they should demand to get some.
I think that is part of the substance. It's hard for the person who speaks the claims of the poor not to sound angry or selfish or impatient. But I think that is part of what's going on in the last 15 years of black consciousness raising, or the last 10 years of Chicano consciousness raising, or the liberation theology move from the third world, that people are saying that they can tell from what they know of the gospel that it ought not be this way. And that how you take the side of the poor, they haven't found all the redemptive recipes we need to make this work. But that they're calling for it is increasingly coming now from the poor world toward the North Atlantic world. And in the name of the gospel. Another one of these books, I don't have the title, but you get very little publishable theology written by people in the ancient Orthodox churches of Asia, especially in southern India. But there is a metropolitan, Mar Ostasios, who has printed a book on the Eucharist and poverty, making the same point. And it comes from India, it comes from South America. So the poor who can speak Christianly are saying it, and certainly many of the other poor have been saying it in other kinds of less gentle ways, in revolutionary movements, most of them failing, but the very call for revolution is a sign of the recognition there's something wrong with this system anyway. We often are frustrated that not many people in other parts of the world are willing to be converted to Christianity without seeing that the Christianity they've seen is one that doesn't do this, doesn't preach this part of the gospel.
Our congregation recently reorganized its social ministry department, and in one of its first sessions with a new board, just set down things that our church would do. Well, they wound up with 2 pages of possibilities. Then had to be selective, of course, and they've been a very busy board, especially with unemployment growing and all that in the local area. So in answer to the concern, what may we do? To sit down and try to make a list.
I think we all need to begin also in a very practical way, not only just talking about the problems of the world, and certainly praying about them, but I think we need to take more seriously stewardship as a way of life with our children, not just a way to raise the budget for our congregation, a Christian lifestyle. And I think for most of us, we need to take seriously, not legalistically, but that 10% is a minimum. And we have to go beyond that, and I think we have to take a look at our wills as to what we do with our estates when we leave here. That's a pretty practical way of talking about sharing our bread.
Yeah, that's one way. Of course, another way is arrange not to need a will because we give it away earlier.
Sure.
We need more freedom from thinking we need property to be secured. Now, whatever shape that takes, we'll have to work at. And there have been forms of legalism about that that haven't sounded like good news, so we need to find more ways. But that we look for them, I think, will be encouraged if we see it as not just a utopianism or the anger of the deprived, but as part of the gospel.
And something a little different from the New Testament may fit in here. What would your reaction be to this statement of him that will not work or not eat?
That was one of the guidelines for governing a community in which they had already taken considerable responsibility for each other. So that someone who was part of this sharing, who could work, was encouraged to work, and pushed to work if he remained in the community. And I'd be in favor of that. That is, this is not a dole. This is those who have sharing with those who don't have. But to the extent to which that community gets structured, well, then all work as they can. So it isn't it isn't grounds for a few people to live off of the others who could be contributing.
Wasn't that also spoken to a community of work that had people standing around expecting Jesus to return?
Yeah, that related to the question of thinking the world is not worth contributing to because it's so short. That was another part of it. But I just wish we had communities in which that there was a point in making that statement. That statement is only meaningful because there was a sharing community where there could be freeloaders. We have such an individually organized, we can't have freeloaders. So warnings against freeloaders are pointless in our culture, in our church culture. They do apply to our welfare problematic and in the wider society. But even they're not nearly as much as the Reaganites would make us think. But it's already a good sign if you have the kind of community that freeloaders can be tempted to take advantage of, as they did in Thessalonica. And we don't. We ought to have a kind of community where freeloading becomes a problem. And then when you have that kind of community, and then you have somebody taking advantage of it, and to ask them to help with the dishes. But the argument against freeloaders is not an argument against not having community in the first place. It's been made that in Rotarian Republican culture.
May I observe that we've had a couple of cases of freeloaders.
Oh, good. That's a good start. You probably found something to do with them, too.
Yes. Not totally. We're still going it out.
Thank you.